Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The federal government remains in business for now, but how will it fare down the road after Democrats and Republicans agreed on a plan to cut some $38 billion from current spending levels to keep government operating through the end of the fiscal year? Joining us now to look forward is Cleveland Plain Dealer Washington Bureau Chief Stephen Koff. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hi, Ann.
So let's talk about the compromise that was cut at the 11th hour. What do we really know about that $38.5 billion in spending cuts?
Well, we know a little bit. We don't know as much as we'd like to know, which is going to be interesting as Congress members, I suppose, learn more. But we know, for instance, that it includes about $13 billion from labor, education, and health and human services departments. It includes about $8 billion from foreign affairs programs. Now, where within those programs, you know, will those specific cuts come? That's still emerging. Apparently, they have saved current enrollment for Head Start, according to Congressional Quarterly, and will maintain the maximum award for Pell Grants. So, you know, there are a few details. In addition to that, we know a little bit about the riders, the things that people wanted to attach. There will not be a Planned Parenthood rider. That's where the Republican caucus wanted to ban all federal funding for Planned Parenthood. We're talking about $330 million there if you include the Medicaid money they get. And
But they cut it for D.C., right?
They still cut it for D.C., indeed. Well, not Planned Parenthood, but abortion. You may not now use, under this particular rider, you cannot use federal money for abortion in the District of Columbia. That's absolutely correct. Likewise, there's still an attempt to – they may have actually succeeded. I'm not clear on this – in removing a protection of the gray wolf in some of the western states from the endangered species list. There is still a debate going on about whether they will exempt or remove some proposed rules from the Department of Education that would make it tougher for for-profit universities to give student loans if those universities or those schools or those programs had high default rates. That's still being hammered out. The rules actually aren't finalized yet, but there are a lot of folks from those schools who are hoping to legislatively just eliminate that problem for them.
The way these deals are cut, does it lend itself to a lot of shenanigans, or it's just an opportunity that lawmakers avail, you know, take advantage of when they can? And it's
well, that's a great question, because as members learn more, they're going to find out, gee, we don't like that deal. We don't like this portion, or we don't like that portion. I guess we have to see, you know, were there shenanigans? Of course, were they terrible? Were they bad enough to keep lawmakers from giving their support? I don't think so. That's a great question, though, because again, these are negotiations that took place behind closed doors, and as members find out what they supposedly are about to vote on, you know, will they still like it? Will they still agree? My guess is yes. John Boehner did extract, I guess, some symbolic things. You know, he's wanted to force the Senate to have a vote on Planned Parenthood, so he says that they will have that vote. He's wanted to force the Senate to have a vote on maintaining what he calls Obamacare. So he wants some of these up and down symbolic votes. They're not going to pass with a Democratic Senate, but nevertheless, he gets a campaign commercial or something out of it.
Is this just a prelude to another shutdown threat at the end of the fiscal year?
At the end of this year, it's possible, you know, look, I mean, here we are midway into this fiscal year, and they're just getting this passed. So we now have to start working on another set of appropriations bills. And the one budget that has been proposed by Paul Ryan in the House is dead on arrival in the Senate. There is no way that can pass. So then is there another shutdown threat? Well, that gets pretty interesting. I mean, they can continue with the continuing resolutions. That's an old trick, and they can always do that. You know, there's been a lot of talk this year on how the House and Senate failed to agree on any spending bills, which is true. But in the past, there have always been one or two or three that they kick over to the next year. So that'd be my best guess is they just kick more over to next year.
You said it's dead on arrival in the Senate, but might they not tweak it and change it up so that it is the vehicle?
Sure, it can be a vehicle. In a way, it probably has to be the vehicle because when, you know, if the House passes something, then that has to become the vehicle for what the Senate does. But the extent of the cuts that the Republicans want in the House with that bill are just too extreme for just about every Democrat. Now, we've got the unknown here, which is what will President Obama propose this? I think it'll be Wednesday in his speech. And, you know, he may propose something pretty deep. We just don't know yet. So, you know, maybe they're negotiating in earnest. Maybe there's going to be some agreement on this. You know, we're going into an election. This is the time when people are sort of rallying their base and saying, you know, yes, we got to cut this, or hell no, you can't cut that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
My guest is Stephen Koff. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He's going to be with us for just about 8 more minutes. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us about this. There's been a lot of very close contact between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner in this past week. Has this been a good thing? Do people generally agree that the more contact, the better in terms of getting the business of state done?
Yeah, probably in terms of personal contact. I don't know that John Boehner was a regular at the White House prior to this. And so, you know, as they get to know one another, I think that they do respect one another. They do respect one another's positions. And when things were getting tough the other night, even, and the president thought there was an agreement, and then there wasn't an agreement, he was on the phone with Speaker Boehner saying, hey, I thought we had a deal here. Come on now. At one point, as I understand it, the vice president got pretty mad, raised his voice a little bit with Boehner. I think they understand one another's positions. I even think the White House appreciates the tough spot that the speaker can be in because he's given his members the right to hear things out, to have their voices heard. And, you know, it's like herding cats, as they say. It's not easy for Boehner. So, yeah, I think that that's probably I don't know if it opens up, you know, any sort of new avenue for there now to be an ongoing dialogue and they're going to agree on things because ideologically, you know, they're apart. But it can't hurt to have them talking.
The New York Times published an article that made John Boehner – of Ohio, by the way, for everyone who's not sure about that, appear as a hero in all of this. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he doesn't like the legislation, but he likes how Boehner is running the House. I was wondering how long that'll last given the makeup of his caucus with its strong branch of uncompromising conservatives.
That's going to be interesting to see. You know, we've got a group of House freshmen, some of them who say they understand what he's doing, but they're going to vote no. In fact, I think Jim Renacci from Ohio is one of those. Jim Jordan, who's another Ohioan, is chairman of the Republican Study Committee, which is sort of a formal name given to a caucus of conservative, fiscally conservative lawmakers. And, you know, and they've always existed, but now they've got a lot more support, especially from these freshmen. And that's a really tough act. So I think you will have them saying, okay, we're going to give some on this, not entirely, but we'll give you something here. But in the future, then no. It's tough to do. Boehner's got a tough job with these guys.
Rod in Columbus, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
According to Mother Jones Magazine, studies in Mother Jones, approximately 83% of the wealth in this country is held by the top 20% of Americans. And, you know, not only has, you know, tax increases for the wealthy not been brought up, but the Republicans are proposing more, you know, more spending cuts for the, or, you know, more tax cuts for the wealthy, as I understand it. And I'd like to get your comment on this.
Tax cuts or tax increases on the wealthy. What are the prospects, Stephen? Thank you, Rod, for the call.
Well, again, as you know, I'm sure Rod knows that the Republican House plan, the Paul Ryan plan, of course, calls for a decrease to bring all the rates down, the top rates down. You're going to see folks who attempt to maintain them. I don't think you're going to see much of a fight to raise them. It's an ongoing issue. I don't see a whole lot of resolution coming anytime soon, though. I mean, this is something we've been discussing and the parties have been debating about for a number of years.
The debt ceiling is the next critical issue at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, it's we're going to hit that debt ceiling, in May, a little bit over $14 trillion. There are some tricks borrowing from, account A to feed account B and that sort of thing that can get them through another few weeks or another month. But at some point, that has to give. And you are going to see, I think, quite the fight over that because the debt is huge. And as a percentage of GDP, it's rising. You've got Democrats who will say and do say that, look, if we improve the economy and as the economy picks up, you'll have more economic activity that then feeds the beast. And I'm sorry, I'm stating that poorly, but takes care of itself. Basically, mm-hmm. we generate more economic activity and we have more tax revenue. Therefore, you have others who say, no, this is ridiculous. It's out of hand. That's going to be an awful tough one to solve because the Republicans are not going to vote to increase that debt ceiling unless they get something.
Isn't that idea that you can tweak things on one side and affect the outcome in terms of economic activity on the other side a premise of this of Ryan's bill, too, that if they cut the taxes, it's going to generate economic activity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They've been arguing that since the days of Reagan. Mm-hmm. And, there are many people who say, well, it's been disproven. I'm not going to jump into that debate.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, absolutely. You've got both sides who vehemently disagree on that.
Well, I want to thank you, Stephen Koff of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Stephen Koff. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Stay tuned. Joining us coming up, Bill Thompson. He's the editor of Birdwatchers Digest. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us for Talk of the Nation beginning at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And in the program today, Cokey and Steve Roberts join host Neil Conan for a look at children, tradition, and love in an interfaith family. That's Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting best-selling author and former lawyer Kristen Hanna, reading from her latest novel, Night Road, Tuesday evening, April 12th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
69 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day. Some of those storms could produce heavy rainfall, and temperatures will be falling throughout the day to about 63 degrees. Rain overnight as well, a low of 43, a little bit of sunshine for Tuesday, and a high of 54. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Moving away from the chirps of politicians in Washington, we move closer to home to talk about the chirps of backyard birds this spring. We welcome in the studio for the first time Bill Thompson III. He's author and also editor of Bird Watchers Digest. Bill, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Ann. It's a real thrill to be here, right in the studio.
Right. No birds in here, but no. Lots of bird talk. Now, before the show started, you mentioned you were just out in the parking lot wandering
right.
around down by the river a little bit.
Down by the river.
What did you see?
Eating government cheese. I saw an osprey flew over, a pair of wood ducks. I saw a robin building a nest in the bushes right out front of your building here. Tree swallow, barn swallow, mallards, of course, the ubiquitous Canada geese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
lots
they're
of
all
birds
over the place.
Right,
yeah, lots of birds.
Right.
Were you surprised or is that just typical?
Well, you know, some of these birds like the wood ducks and the swallows and the osprey are all just back. You know, they've spent the winter farther south where the weather's been a little bit more pleasant. And now they're back here to start nesting, or in some cases they'll be passing through headed farther north. But, you know, from now until the next, through the next about month and a half, it's the best time for bird watching here in Ohio, because we've got all the resident birds are tuning up and starting to nest, and all the migrants are coming through. Birds are returning for spring, so it's a great time for people to be outside bird watching.
And be looking up, or where do you think people should be going to look?
And, you know, anywhere? Step right out your back door and just listen. And, I mean, everything, the amount of bird singing from now until, you know, really through the until the summer doldrums, is it just gets better and better every day. So I would encourage people to go outside. Just close your eyes and listen. It's pretty cool.
We have some cuts of bird sounds that we brought with us, but before we get started on that, I want to just welcome our listeners to give us a call if you want to talk with Bill Thompson. He's in the studio today. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll talk about his new book out. It's with Connie Toops, Bill Thompson III and Connie Toops, Hummingbirds and Butterflies. We'll talk about that as well, and also his other newish book, Identifying and Feeding Birds. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can go onto Facebook, the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page, and post your question or comment there. Coming up now, the hermit thrush. Let's hear. Boy, that's really pretty.
It's beautiful. And I love how, if you listen closely, you can actually hear the mosquitoes in the background of that recording. Yeah, hermit thrush is a bird that they nest here in a couple of different places in Ohio, down in sort of Hocking Hills in those sandstone hemlock gorges that we have down there, and then along the northern tier. But most of my experience with hermit thrushes has been in the mountains in West Virginia. And there are people who would argue vehemently that that's the most beautiful bird song there is. You know, the thrushes have this special vocal arrangement where they can sing multiple tones at once.
Yeah.
And so it makes for, if you slow that song down and listen to it, it sounds like a horn section playing.
Have you done that?
Oh, yeah. That's phenomenal. It's really, really cool, too.
And are there more variations on that theme with the hermit thrush?
Yeah, most birds, I mean, I think this is something that a lot of people, even a lot of experienced bird watchers, don't necessarily understand. It's that while we might say, oh, that's a Carolina wren singing, that's a hermit thrush singing, that's an American robin, each individual bird has, just like we humans all
right.
don't sound exactly like, each individual bird has little variables in their song. So they might sing the same thing for a little bit and then change it up slightly and change it up slightly. And that's just the way nature is with making for diverse options, if you will. So, you know, a male American robin singing right now might try one song for a while. No success, might try a different song, right?
Yeah, just like an outfit.
Like any pop star.
All right. Melissa in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me. I was awakened yesterday morning by a very unique bird sound, and I've been dying to know what it was. I was excited to hear you were talking about birds this morning. It sounded to me like a squeaky playground swing. I wish I could describe it. It was just sort of that... Like if you think about what a playground swing
is. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't know if they still squeak with the new generation of playground swings,
yeah,
but I think we're all in the same boat there.
Right.
Bill, any?
Well, you know, it could have been one of a number of things. Right now, there are lots of blackbirds. What you could have heard was a red-winged blackbird, one of our real signs of spring here in Ohio in sort of February, late January. The male red-winged blackbirds come back, and they kind of have a you know, conquer-ee kind of songs. You might not hear the first part of it, but it's a very common bird. As you drive along the road, any place there's a wet ditch with some cattails, look for it's a really well-named bird. It's a blackbird with red on its wings. And the males, as they sing, will flare those wings and show their little red shoulder patches. So that could have been one, but there are other birds, too. I mean, you know, a starling could have made that sound. There's a warbler that's just back in Ohio in the last few days, and they'll be here all summer, called the black and white warbler, which sounds kind of like a squeaky gerbil wheel, like wee-see, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But my guess is it probably was a red-winged blackbird.
Okay, I'll have to keep an eye out for it. Thank you very much.
Sure
Thanks,
thing.
Melissa.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guest in the studio today is Bill Thompson III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. They had a little fun, put a little joke on my intern.
Well, we weren't singling
one her. One of her questions was, what prompted the new name change of your magazine, Birdwatchers Digest, to Wild Birdwatchers World? So.
And Blooms, yeah.
And Blooms, okay.
Yeah, we got a lot of feedback on that. It was a April Fool's joke, which maybe we made a little bit too subtle, but I had some people email me saying, oh, that's so – oh, I loved Birdwatchers Digest. Why did you change it?
And you were, of course, going to be the new cover star of the magazine,
right.
Just like Oprah.
Right, just like Oprah. I said, just like Oprah and Martha Stewart, I want to do what I love doing best, which is being on the front cover of a magazine.
You said you saw two life birds on your last trip to Florida.
Right.
Now what's a life bird and what does it mean?
That's a good question. A life bird, most bird watchers keep a list of the birds they've seen, and many of us keep what's known as a life list, which is a list of all the birds that you've seen at least once in your life. So, for example, if you and I walked out of the studio here and I said, hey, look there, Ann, there's an osprey flying over, you'd said, I've never seen one of those before in my life. That's a life bird. So it's the first time you've seen it in your life. So we keep a life list of all the birds we've seen. There are 850 or so species of birds in North America. So for an active bird watcher to see sort of 400, 500, that's really saying something. To get to 600, 700, that's getting into sort of rare air. So I don't actively pursue life birds like a cuckoo person. I sometimes get that urge, but for the most part, I enjoy encountering them when I can. So I'm going to Oklahoma in a couple of days to speak at a birding festival out there, and there are two birds I'm hoping to see out there, a lesser prairie chicken and a black-capped vireo.
Now, lesser prairie chicken, Julie Zickafoos, your spouse, wrote about that,
right.
I think, last year.
Yeah, that's on this. She wrote about it, and she's got on this cover of the magazine was
her
painting of lesser prairie chickens. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a cool bird. It's a very endangered bird, as many of our grassland species are. It's very specialized habitat. You know, out where we're putting these wind farms and
prairies,
cell towers
yeah.
in the prairies, and sort of certain kinds of fencing that are very economical for the ranchers to use are very bad for the prairie chickens. So one of the things we're doing at this festival is going out and marking fences so the prairie chickens can see them. They don't fly into them accidentally.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's a bird that's just highly endangered. It was hunted a lot. It's very specialized in its habitat preferences. So it'll be really cool to see. I'm sneaking out into a blind at 4 in the morning to be there when they start their mating display.
That's a very specific thing that they do too.
Yeah, the lekking. It's the males get together and sort of it's like a dance off, you know. They dance and call and they sort of try to intimidate each other. And the women, just like with humans, watch from the side while the men posture and fight. And then they pick the most macho guy and they go and make some prairie chickens together.
Sarah from Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Enjoy the program very much.
Thank you.
And had a question about juncos. That's J-U-N-C-O-S for people that might be listening. And they spend the winter here in Ohio. And I've been kind of tracking when they actually leave to migrate north. And I noticed something this year because I was paying particularly careful attention to them. And Saturday, I still had juncos in my backyard. Yesterday, I did not see a single junco all day. So my question is this. First of all, do they migrate at night, and do they go together as a group?
Really good questions. You know, we had this nice warm front that came through yesterday, and in spring and fall, when a weather front moves through, it sort of gives the birds some added incentive to move out. So in the fall, when a cold front comes through, people will call up Birdwatchers Digest and say, what happened to my hummingbirds? They're all gone. And really, there are a bunch of different things that inspire birds to go. They have sort of an internal clock that tells them when it's time to go. So your feeders or your bird bath or your birdhouses aren't going to keep birds from migrating. They naturally are driven to do that at a certain point when the light gets to a certain way. But when a front comes through, it often birds use those fronts to move. And the juncos there are a few that, you know, they do nest in northern Ohio, a little bit in the Hocking Hills down there where there's sort of a northern bit of habitat. But they're usually gone by about late April, first of May. So I would still think you'll have some juncos from farther south passing through your yard over the next few weeks. By about May, when they should be breeding, they'll, for the most part, be out of central Ohio and certainly out of where I live in southern Ohio. They do migrate in loose flocks. You can hear on a still night, you can go out and listen, and you'll hear these noises coming from the sky like,
wow.
And these are birds communicating with each other, saying, hey, I'm over here. Which way you headed? I'm headed this way.
So it is at nighttime primarily that they move?
Most of our songbirds do migrate at night because it's cooler and it's safer. They're safer from predators.
And someone said they use the stars to migrate. Is that true?
There's a lot of debate about that. We think that birds have kind of a little magnetic compass in their brains that allows them to navigate toward the poles. They also seem to use the electromagnetic waves that surround the planet. Sometimes they use the stars, we think, because we've done tests with a bird called an indigo bunting where they put it in a planetarium with an ink pad that its feet would get ink on, and then they rotated the night sky, the stars, and the bird went toward the north in the spring and inked up that side of the room. So they did it a different way, and the bird did seem to navigate using the stars to a certain extent, not exclusively, but to a certain extent. So we do think birds are kind of tuned in like Galileo was with the night sky.
Wow. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Bye-bye.
You know, it was a record 84 degrees yesterday. It was strange weather, not freakishly, but it was a record.
It was summer,
nonetheless.
All of a sudden.
How often does that mess up the migration patterns?
You know, I don't really think temperature does a whole lot to migration patterns. What it might do, if we had a warm spell, like a week or two of warm fronts coming up, you know, sort of bringing birds up from the south, a lot of times in spring, that'll happen, especially with birds like purple martins and tree swallows. They'll come back. These are insect eaters. They eat flying insects, and that's it for the most part, although tree swallows are a little bit more adaptable. They'll eat some berries from time to time. But this is a bad thing. Then all of a sudden we get one of those Easter snowstorms, and these birds are stranded with no food.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people who are purple martin landlords, have a big purple martin colony, who when that snow happens and there are no flying insects, will go out with little plastic spoons and fling mealworms up into the air so their martins will come and catch them and eat them to help the martins survive. Because the martins only are trained to eat on the wing. They don't know to, let me fly down to the ground and eat that bug. So, yeah, I mean, I think birds can get caught out by weather. Certainly we know we lost a large chunk of our hummingbird population when Hurricane Katrina came.
Right.
So they're affected by weather, but on a day-to-day basis, not so much. It's more longer trends, I think.
Brian, in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much. My question's about a simple black cat. Chickadee, they make different sounds, chickadee, dee, dee, and then sometimes just chickadee, and I wanted to know if there's different reasons for that.
Good question. Yes, there are different reasons for that. And here in central Ohio, we're kind of on the dividing line between Carolina chickadees and black cap chickadees. Black caps are to the north of us here. Carolinas are to the south. So here in the Columbus area, I'm not sure if you know necessarily, unless you look carefully and listen to their song, whether or not you have Carolina chickadees or black cap chickadees. This time of year, you hear chickadees singing. They sound sort of like.
Yeah.
And they also do the chickadee dee dee. The chickadee dee dee is really their call, and that's what they're using to communicate. So when you hear one going, chickadee dee 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 dee, that's a scold. They're mad about something, or they're warning their flock about danger, there's a cat, or there's a snake. When they're just going kind of chickadee chickadee dee, in a sort of less harsh way, it's probably just communicating with their fellow flock mates. You know, chickadees are one of those species that they're here year round. They don't migrate, and they spend the time often in the winter and until about this time of year. With a mixed flock, with nuthatches and titmice and downy woodpeckers and sometimes warblers and kinglets and creepers. And they're all talking to each other. Hey, I found some food over here. Come on over here. And they have these little call notes that they do. It's a fascinating thing once you start digging in and trying to determine what birds are actually saying. You know, they do have different vocalizations for different purposes.
Yeah, I was whistling to one the other day, and he came up. got quite aggressive with me. Came right up on a fence next to me. So
yeah, I probably thought you were the biggest chickadee he'd ever heard. And he was ready to, you know.
Ugly, too, Brian.
Punch you right in the face until he saw how big you were.
Thanks a lot for your call, Brian.
Thank you.
Take care. Paul from Elyria, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hola. Hey, just a quick question. I have a bird that wakes me up every morning. I'm a dud at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I think he's the only English-speaking bird that I've ever heard. And he says the same thing every morning. It sounds like he's saying, birdie, 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 birdie. And I'm wondering, what kind of bird is it that it's almost English-sounding? I mean, it's just uncanny.
It sounds like he's actually enunciating the word birdie.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is the state bird of Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what that is?
Is it the cardinal?
The northern cardinal. That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he's actually telling you that you're purdy, purdy, purdy.
Oh,
that's what he's saying.
Okay.
Let me interpret for you. That's actually what he's saying. So he must be looking in the window.
Okay.
Yeah, cardinals this time of year are singing like crazy, and the males are singing from like every treetop they can find, and they're fighting and they're setting up their territory. So this is their most vocal time of year by far. And we have tons and tons of cardinals in Ohio.
Right.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you. I was just curious what it was, and okay, thank you very much.
Sure
thank
thing.
You, Paul. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now, Bill Thompson III, he is editor of Birdwatchers Digest and author of many books about birds. I've got in front of me his newest that he co-wrote with Connie Toops. It's called Hummingbirds and Butterflies. Bill is going to be presenting a program for the Columbus Natural History Society, No Child Left Inside, Birds as a Doorway to Nature at the OSU Museum of Biological Diversity. It's at 1315 Kinnear Road. It's free and open to the public. And the doors open at 7 p.m. for socializing and refreshments. We'll try to get a link up there on the website at wosu.org/allsides if you want to get more information about this. wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link up there for you on Bill's program for tonight. Otherwise, you can give us a call and talk with Bill yourself, 614-292-8513. And Justin in Grove City, you're asking a question that I'm curious about, too. It's a good one. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. My name's Justin. I was just wondering about the emerald ash borer or ash borer. What birds eat those, and how can we promote them? And I just don't. You know, you hear about the ash borer all the time, but I don't think you hear about the birds that actually eat them. You know.
Well, you know, Justin, I'm not familiar with any birds specifically that do eat the ash borer. However, if there were going to be any birds that would eat a wood-boring insect, it would be the woodpeckers. That's a really good question. I need to look that up because we're getting that
you're getting it down
invasive
there
creature in southeastern Ohio, and we love our ash trees. They're very bird-friendly trees, you know. So if there were any birds that were going to eat the ash borer, it would be a woodpecker, and I would imagine it would be the larger woodpeckers that would be kind of excavating, trying to get at these tunnels, because we know that our woodpeckers eat things like carpenter ants and termites, and they readily eat that kind of stuff. So that if anything eats it, I would imagine it's that. However, some of these invasive insects, you know, from Asia or from another part of the world, don't have any natural enemies, if you will, any natural things that prey upon them, because it's these birds here have evolved without the knowledge or the ability to eat emerald ash borers. And who knows, they could be toxic. It's a really good question. That's worth looking into.
Taste funny or something like that?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure about taste funny, but, you know, there are a lot of insects that like monarchs, for example, that birds eat them, and there's a toxin in there that kind of makes them sick.
Yeah.
So they know not to eat that. A lot of our yellow and orange insects are toxic that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Justin.
Cool. You're welcome.
We're going to have to take a break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Bill Thompson, editor of Birdwatchers Digest. We'll also hear some more bird sounds and take your questions and comments at 614-292-8513. If you can't call us, you can email us at allsides at WOSU.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Do you leave the faucet on when brushing your teeth or soak the sidewalk as you water the lawn? On the next Fresh Air, The Future of Water, Charles Fishman, author of The Big Thirst, says we have to think differently about how we use this resource.
I think we're leaving the golden age of water in the developed world. Water that has been safe, unlimited, and essentially free.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and a conversation with Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Knapke. She'll be talking about creating and maintaining all types of gardens and the best plants for Ohio. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News no matter where you are by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org, and with a simple click of the mouse, you can listen to your favorite radio station online. Listen to local and national news anytime online at WOSU.org. And rain off and on throughout the day today, maybe a few thunderstorms, and temperatures falling today as well. Rain overnight and a low of 43 degrees. A little bit of sunshine for Tuesday, a high of 54. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Bill Thompson III. He's author of, with Connie Toops, of Hummingbirds and Butterflies and Identifying and Feeding Birds. We talked with Bill about that book last winter during our fun drive. And he's here in person, as promised. So if you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, and we'll try to get to it as soon as possible. First, though, let's go to another bird sound. This is a tree swallow. Bill, is that a common tree swallow?
It's, yeah, and I need to point out for your listeners, Ian, that they don't actually swallow trees.
Okay. Just a little technicality there.
Barn swallows don't swallow barns. Bank swallows, however, do swallow banks. So I suggest you get your money out of the bank right now. No, tree swallows are very common here in Ohio. They're actually expanding, and their population's really kind of booming. They nest in cavities like our bluebirds and chickadees do, and our tree swallows got back just a little bit early this year. They're already starting to build a nest in our meadow. You have tree swallows right outside the studio. I saw a pair of them arguing over a nest box as I was on my way in this morning. So interesting. You could also, in the background of that little sound clip, you could hear the red-winged blackbird that an earlier caller was asking about.
Sue in Morrow County, I'm looking for you. Sue, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann and Mr. Thompson. I gave up feeding the birds a couple of years ago because of the raccoons. They not only ate the feed, but they destroyed the feeders as well. Do you have any tips or suggestions for dealing with this problem?
What destroyed your feeder?
The raccoons.
Oh, raccoons. Oh, yeah. Ooh. Well, we have actively acrobatic raccoons on our farm in southern Ohio, and we have to baffle our feeders. So we mount the feeders on a metal pole, and we put a metal stovepipe baffle beneath the pole. And if you want some information on how to build one of these baffles, just Google Predator Baffle on the internet, or you can go to our website, birdwatchersdigest.com, and there are some plans on there for how to make a baffle. You can also buy them at stores, but you need to put your feeders out a place where a raccoon or a squirrel can't leap from, like your deck or your tree. Get them out kind of in the middle of an open area and then baffle them from below, and that pretty much prevents the climbing raccoons from accessing the feeders. But it's tough. Our raccoons, till we finally got a big enough baffle, would climb up, help each other over the baffle, not just empty the feeders, but actually steal the feeders and take them down into the woods. So every you know, late winter, early spring, we'd have the feeder retrieval trip down into the woods to go find all our feeders. And the raccoons are pretty bad. They're starting to get active now, too. And you really need to get a baffle below the feeders to kind of keep them from getting up there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you, Sue. Melissa in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I just have a question about the whippoorwills and the mockingbirds. I was in southeastern Ohio and heard a mocking whippoorwill last summer, and I was just curious, do they make it this far north in Ohio?
Yeah, they sure do. They're just not back yet. And here's how to tell when they're going to be back. When you have your light on in your house or your front porch, and you start seeing moths that are about bigger than a quarter that come into the light, that's about the time the whippoorwills show up. And it'll be any week now, they'll be back. But this is whippoorwills, because they specialize in eating night-flying moths. And, you know, we've had these ongoing sort of waves of gypsy moth infestations, and there's been all kinds of aerial spraying for that.
Correct.
The bad thing about the spraying for the gypsy moth, which is an invasive exotic insect, is that it kills all the other flying insects and all the other night-flying moths. And that's what whippoorwills and chuckwills widows and nighthawks, you know, rely on. So when these things are gone, the insects are gone, the birds can't survive, and their range, you know, retreats basically. But yeah, the whippoorwills ought to be back within the next 10 days, I would say. Watch for the big moths.
Well, that's wonderful. I've never heard them this far north here in central Ohio. What about mockingbirds? Did they make it this far north also?
Let's listen to some sound of a mockingbird, and then Bill, let's talk about that. Melissa, thanks for your call. This is the northern mockingbird. I don't know. That's pretty fancy, too. I think that would rival the hermit thrush.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, mockingbirds, they get their name because they are imitating other birds or mocking them.
Okay.
And they are incredibly versatile songsters. And if you listen to a mockingbird as opposed to a brown thrasher, which is another bird that sounds very similar, the mockingbird repeats things multiple times. So it'll go, tweedle, 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 diddle-it, 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 dido, 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 dido. Whereas the thrasher just does everything sort of twice. It's one way to, you know, from a sound perspective, to tell them apart. But, yeah, mockingbirds are all through Ohio. They're a little bit more common in the southern part. And we have them in Marietta. We don't always have one on our farm every winter, but they love to defend a territory. And they'll fly down and peck people on the head, cats, dogs, anything passing through their territory. And right now is when they're singing like crazy, even singing at night now. So you can, anytime you hear a bird singing a very variable song for a long extended period of time, it's probably going to be a northern mockingbird.
Pat in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a place in the Hocking Hills, and we get lots of birds down there. I haven't seen any bluebirds. We're in the boonies, kind of in an area you'd call a hollow. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's why bluebirds aren't there.
Yeah, bluebirds really like wide open spaces. A good friend of mine just bought a place down in the Hocking Hills, and she was really wanting bluebirds. And I said, you need to have some nice open meadow or a big open lawn. And so they opened up one part of their old field and kind of made it grassy and, as opposed to brushy, and she got bluebirds. So, the bluebirds, they're perch and hunt feeders, so they love to sit up and look for something moving in the grass or just above the grass, and they'll fly down and get it. So they need wide open sort of grassy habitat. They don't really spend any time at all in the woods.
Thank you, Pat. Speaking of grassy lands, Charles in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Just a quick question. I live on a farm outside of Delaware, and I'm thinking about converting one of the pastures, like a 9-acre pasture, from just horse pasture grasses to a prairie, like a native prairie mix, in hopes of attracting some of the less common sparrows and other pasture or prairie birds. Do you have an idea whether that will be effective or not?
Oh, I think it'll totally be effective. You know, this part of Ohio, sort of central and western and northwestern Ohio, was prairie originally. It was native grassland, and there's very little of that left. And any place you have a patch of a couple of acres or more, you get these grassland species, things like Dick Sissels and Bob Whites and Henslow sparrows and grasshopper sparrows and bobolinks. These are all birds that have been indirectly persecuted by us turning our native grassland into hayfield or agricultural fields. And so anytime you make a patch like that, and it sounds like you'll have a nice big spot, you'll definitely get those birds. It may take a few years for the population to filter in, but you'll definitely get them. I would highly encourage that. That's a great idea.
Thank you, Charles.
All right, thanks.
Take care. Let's see. Linda from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I recently connected with a high school friend, and we're coming up on our 50th reunion, so it's been a while. And she is the most magnificent bird photographer I've ever seen. And Bill may have heard of her. I've never had. Her name is Carol Lobier.
Hmm.
And she does have some work out on YouTube. She did this winter, the snowbirds. This came to her deck from her house.
Oh, wow.
She's got them just taking off, just as they spread their wings to take off. But it's just magnificent. So you may want to look at it.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Linda. Amy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. We just found this morning a bright green and yellow parakeet at our feeder. And we're wondering how to feed it or how to keep it safe and help it. It doesn't seem to be able to fly as well as the rest of the native bird.
You actually were able to catch it?
We have not tried to catch it.
Okay.
Have seen it in our backyard.
Right. And does it seem healthy or does it not seem healthy?
It does seem healthy.
Okay.
It just doesn't fly as well as the other birds and kind of is a little lost.
I see, yeah. Probably somebody's pet that's escaped. Most parrots and parakeets eat seed when they're being kept as pets. So I would encourage you to go down to the pet store and get some canary seed. Even just regular old mixed seed from the feed store would work too. And just put it out there. You might even actually put it out in a little cup because it might be used to eating out of a cup if it is an escaped pet.
Okay.
And then if it gets weak to the point where you can actually catch it, I would suggest that you do that and then maybe call your local pet store or put up a notice there. Somebody's probably lost this pet.
Right.
Put out some water, too. That would be good.
Okay.
And just kind of hope for the best. If it is an escaped pet, it's probably going to not fly away when you try to catch it. It may be actually welcome the help.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you, Amy. We have a message from the field from Steph with the Ohio Division of Forestry. Writes, woodpeckers love emerald ash borers.
Oh, awesome.
Borer larvae.
Okay.
In fact, it was woodpeckers scraping the ash bark to a yellow color that alerted a homeowner that something was wrong and led to Ohio's first ash borer find in White House.
Mm.
Unfortunately, woodpeckers do little to control large populations of the emerald ash borer.
Okay,
so,
that's really good to know.
Yeah.
We figured it would be woodpeckers if it was anybody.
Thank you, Steph, from the Ohio Division of Forestry. We have an email from Mark in Columbus. He says, are there any good websites that would help me identify a bird based on the calls I hear?
Yeah, there are a couple of good websites for that. There's naturesounds.org is a site that a fellow named Lang Elliott has. It's recordings of all kinds of birds and animals and amphibians and things like that. And then allaboutbirds.org, I think it is. The Cornell Lab has a lot of bird sounds that you can listen to. Those are two good resources. And then, of course, there are lots of good Department of the Interior websites that have profiles of birds. So if you just Google bird identification of bird sounds, you'll get lots of really good options on the web. I wish the web had been around when I was a kid, starting bird watching. It would have been awesome.
I don't know if you would have been outside looking at birds enough, though.
Yeah, true.
Elizabeth in Cincinnati, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I like to feed the birds in winter, but I prefer not to do it into spring and summer. But I didn't know if it was all right just to stop feeding them, or should I wean them off?
Oh, it's perfectly fine to feed in the summer. The only thing I caution people against well, two things really in summer is, one, if you're feeding suet, unrendered suet, the white stuff you get in the grocery store in the meat section, sometimes if the summer's really hot, that stuff gets melted and kind of rancid, and some of the birds that go to eat it get it on their feathers, and that's not very good for them. So we usually stop feeding suet in the summer at our house. The other thing is you really need to be careful about keeping your feeders clean in the summer, because with the warmer weather, there's a lot more chance that pathogens will survive around the feeders. And so it's really important that you clean the feeders every couple of weeks if you can with some bleachy, soapy water. And we have instructions on how to clean your feeders on our website, birdwatchersdigest.com, if you want step-by-step instructions on how to clean them. But those are the two things. Other than that, it's really a great time of year to feed, because you get to see, in many cases, adult birds bringing the young to the feeders.
It's a misperception that you ought to wean birds from bird feeders in the summer.
What we need to remember, Ann, is that we feed birds for us, really. The birds don't need our feeders as much as we'd love to be needed. We all love to be needed, after all.
They'll find it somewhere else, though.
They will. And birds are really adaptable at finding food. So we do it for us, so we owe it to the birds to do it right. And that part of that's maintaining the feeder hygiene. But I love summer feeding. It's a really great thing.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Time to squeeze in one more call, and it has to be Tess in Westerville, because I want to know who attacked you, Tess. Welcome to the show. Can you make it quick, though, because we're running out of time?
I have taught a lot at resorts. I teach yoga at resorts in the Riviera Maya in Mexico, and they have a black bird. It looks like a crow, and they sit on top of the palapas. They look to be very territorial. They posture. And one time I was walking along with my yoga mat, and I felt something grab the back of my head, and I thought it was a purse. I thought, who would do that? And I turned around, and the men cleaning the beach were pointing and gesticulating, and I looked up, and there he was, and then he attacked me again.
It was a great tail grackle.
Okay.
Big, long, normal? Black tail, big, long, black bill.
Yeah, and they will take each one of those palapa things, and they'll posture at each other.
They're really noisy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Great tail grackle.
It was all talk of the resort among the staff, because they said that they had never seen one attack a person.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Tess. I'm glad we could clear that up.
All right.
Thanks for listening. That's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Bill Thompson, III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. Hope you'll join us again, Bill.
I'd love to, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Bill will be at the with the Columbus Natural History Society tonight. His presentation, No Child Left Behind, Birds as a Doorway to Nature at the OSU Museum of Biological Diversity. You can get more about that on WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks for listening. That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.